Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
A psychoanalytic way of understanding sees humans as inherently divided between love and hatred of reality. Reality is hated when it thwarts our wishes, which are at times irrational and dominated by unconscious fantasies, and also when it exposes us to too much emotional pain. We need support and containment to bear reality. It's New Books in Psychoanalysis. I'm Richard Briette. I'm here with Sally Weintraub. Sally is a practicing psychoanalyst, a fellow of the Institute of Psychoanalysis in London, author of numerous articles, including Links Between Grievance, Complaint, and Different Forms of Entitlement, Violence, and Mental Space, and A Dehumanizing Form of Prejudice as Part of Narcissistic Pathological Organization. Sally's joining us from London to discuss a book she edited called Engaging with Climate Change, Psychoanalytic and Interdisciplinary Perspectives, which was released in 2013 by Routledge. The book is based on a conference held at the Institute of Psychoanalysis in London in 2010. Sally Weintraub, welcome to New Books.
Thank you. Hello, Richard.
Hello. I want to start by talking about a quote which I found really compelling, which is in the very, very beginning of the book, by Hannah Siegel. It's actually by Hannah Siegel's grandson, who was talking about her at her funeral. He says, "For Granny, the take-home message was that however dark the circumstances, it's essential to keep a little fire burning. In that conversation, she said how important it was for psychoanalysts to keep a little fire burning in the face of what she called, quote, the anti-mind approach." It's a really striking quote. And I felt like it captured the overall ethos of the conference and the book. Can you talk about that quote and what it means to you?
Well, I agree. It's a very powerful quote. I was greatly privileged to be at Hannah Siegel's funeral. I think she's had a tremendously powerful impact on me and a whole generation of psychoanalysts. Mm-hmm. And also, she was a psychoanalyst who believed that psychoanalysts have a neutral position, but they shouldn't be neutered. She had things to say about the political mind as well and politics, and had a great influence on me. Anyway, to go to the quote, I think an important part of that quote is it's important to keep a little fire burning. Mm-hmm. And I understand by that she's talking about love and care and mindfulness. She's talking about it has deep links for her with a position in psychoanalysis, which has come to be known as the depressive position. Mm-hmm. I hate all this jargon. It doesn't mean that we're depressed.
Right.
In a clinical sense, but it does mean that we're in touch with, love and concern.
Right. I know that Winnicott. I know that Winnicott also has a version of it called the capacity for concern.
Yes, right. Yes. He's talking about very similar things. Mm-hmm. And so, to go back to your previous quote, you know, there's the issue of the conflict between a love of reality and a hatred of reality. That's the quote that you gave from the book. And I think that expresses, the love of reality, is what I think Hannah Segal would identify with a struggle to be mindful and to stay in touch with, the fact that reality also brings painful feelings and experience, you know, and to try and use one's love to constrain the part of one that wants to just express one's wishes and hates reality.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think she would identify, as would many psychoanalysts, with an anti-mind approach.
Right.
Now, what she meant by an anti-mind approach was not just a statement of individual psychic conflict. I think she used that phrase more pointedly because I think she felt that cultures could come under the influence of an anti-mind approach.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that... anti-mind for Hannah Segal was also linked with destructive forces that operate which are sort of fueled by omnipotence. She wrote a lot about omnipotence.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we'll get into that more directly once we talk about chapter 9 of the book that you wrote, which really explores the relationship between capitalism and culture and how this kind of anti-mind approach happens in cultural experience.
Do you mind, Richard, if I just finish off one thought about that before we move on to
absolutely.
Chapter 9? Because it might make sense to people in terms of omnipotence and Hannah Segal's ideas and so on.
Sure.
It's about climate change. An omnipotent position, in Segal's terms, would be, for instance, to see that there's a problem, like rising carbon emissions,
right.
And to use omnipotence to solve it, to have a kind of a magic solution. She called it technically a manic repair.
Mm.
For example, you could set a whole lot of targets, which is what governments do, you know. In fact, our own coalition government, Conservative Party led here at the moment, set the most ambitious targets ever. We're going to have the greenest government ever.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to cut this, and we're going to do emissions, and we're going to do this, and we're going to roll it all out. But it's not genuine.
Right.
And now that would be an omnipotent solution. What it does is and that's anti-mind. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It creates a virtual world in which, you just solve things. It's a quick fix. And what you're actually solving is something very difficult and something that's going to cause you emotional pain as well as hard labor, which the genuine depressive approach to damage would lead you to.
Mm-hmm.
So you just do a quick fix. And, and that's a manic repair. And the whole area of climate change is absolutely full of this kind of magical thinking. That's what she meant by omnipotence. Anyway, I just thought I'd add that in.
I think magical thinking is a great way to put it. Thinking about it, the idea of climate change, I think, for me, a pivotal way of looking at it in terms of a psychoanalytic context is that it's as though there's a moment when a person realizes the potential reality of what climate change, what the impact will be. It's almost like it's a kind of onset of a traumatic realization.
Yes.
And certainly for me, I can think of a couple of points in my life where that really was a kind of experience. And that once you, at least for me, once you realize that it's almost a kind of clarity that comes upon you about this is very, very serious, there is such a kind of array of fantasies that you can just latch onto very quickly to make that anxiety go away. Whether it be conspiracy theories about science or climate, the deniers, there's sort of one discourse after another that you can latch onto and make yourself feel better.
Mm.
So the exciting part of this book is in part, I think, what would it mean to overcome or to accept that anxiety in a loving way, I think. Would you say that's, am I getting that right?
I'm not sure. Perhaps you could say a bit more.
The fact that we're talking about a denial of a reality, which is the impact of climate change, and the fact that things are really going to change causes an anxiety.
Mm.
And I think it's as though this is a story, kind of a person realizing something that makes them anxious and then choosing to find a way of thinking or a fantastic way of thinking that relieves the anxiety, that makes it go away. And so the question is,
how do we think about it?
Exactly. How do we reintegrate?
Well, one of the difficulties with climate change is that, you know, it's a subject that one needs just to go into. There's nothing simple to say about it.
Mm-hmm.
But so, you know, one's not going to wrap it up in a few sentences. But I think I'm increasingly getting interested in the way in which I think, you know, if we talk about anxiety-generating subjects in any sphere of life, mm-hmm. we need support to be able to bear them. You know, people can only bear things up to a certain point, and then they get over-anxious, and then they push it away, or they change the subject, or whatever it is. And I find, I'm giving quite a lot of talks on climate change now, and I find that, you know, it's... You have to stay very close to people. I find myself using my own examples of, like you did, about how, you know, how one comes to these moments.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we need a lot of support to bear the anxiety. And I think that to take it in and stay with it, to be able to live with it enough to change us and to get us involved, because I think we need to get involved or we're going to sort the problem. We've got very little time. You know, so the question is, I think the subject makes one feel anxious about the future. It makes one feel guilty because one realizes, if one thinks about it really hard, that it's because of our way of living that this is, you know, we're all a little bit implicated in it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's an awful lot against us thinking about it. I don't think it's just individual anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're in a culture where if you raise the subject, people don't want to talk about it.
Right.
So there's huge sort of social pressure to avoid talking about the seriousness. You know, I think we're in a culture, what I'm explicit these days is I think we're in a culture of uncare, that actually, you know, it suits the culture that we don't talk about climate change, we don't recognize how serious it is, because in a way, to put it simply, it keeps us consuming, doesn't it, which is a carbon-intensive thing to be doing. So, you know, you refer to magical thinking. I call them these days our cover stories, you know, the things that we very quickly thoughts we very quickly have, like, well, you know, it's not, there's nothing I can do, and it's China, and it's this and that, and, you know, we change the subject, and we have, as you say, you know, but I think the culture drives this. So I don't think, when we think about climate change, one of the complications is that I think we've internalized a whole culture that is in disavowal about climate change. It's minimizing it. And it's not just that as individuals we, you know, we're in disavowal.
Right.
I think the problem is how do you then break with the culture so that you can see things a bit more clearly for yourself, you know, and how do you survive those moments of acute anxiety that you talk about and that anyone experiences if they actually really look at the situation, you know. And I think another thing I want to add is that, to me, the real tragedy of climate change, in a way, not even the rising emissions, which is bad enough, is the inaction. Because the more inaction there is, the harder it is for us to actually face what's going on, because the more anxious it makes us, and the more overwhelming, you know, it becomes a trauma, you know, so that... this is the real problem, is that it renders us less able to cope But we still have to, and we still have to take this in because, you know, we still have the time to actually turn this around and break with this culture of disavowal and start talking about it. And we need to take it in order to do that. But the tragedy is that because of the inaction, it's making it harder and harder. It's a bit like a vicious circle.
Exactly.
Yep.
Well, for example, the idea that it's not too late, that there are still things that can be done, that there's even a point to that where we have to be realistic that damage is going to happen, that we have to be more open to the real complication of the issue, that it's not all going to be better, but we can make it not as bad.
Absolutely.
And so, again, it's hard to make that a compelling vision, I think. Unless, as you say, we can change the culture of how we experience nature, and maybe you could say even the ideology of nature.
Mm.
And, you know, you talk about that, for example, in this chapter, on chapter 9. Should we
talk
a bit about that? Okay.
Yep.
It's called On the Love of Nature and on Human Nature. And it talks about this idea of an internal landscape, which I thought was really compelling. But you talk about one of your favorite writers, William Hudson.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what really grabbed me about this chapter was you start to explore what it would be like, both I think in a personal way and a cultural way, to have an investment in sort of nurturing and developing a personal sense of what nature is outside of this ideology. Would you say that I have that right?
Yes, I would put it in the way I put it in that chapter is, mm-hmm. I think that, you know, if you look at any little child, I think we're primed to love nature.
Mm-hmm.
Little children love nature. You know, it's very obvious and are fascinated by it. And, you know, so it's not something in that sense that I think we need to cultivate. If anything, I think our social practices have alienated us from nature.
Mm-hmm.
I would put it that way around, actually. And, of course, nature is a very complicated part of reality. It's not all roses and beautiful views. It's got a hard side too. It's appreciating death,
mm-hmm.
and struggle, and you know, life forces and death forces and so on. You know, so. But I think we do live in ways that alienate us from nature.
Mm-hmm.
Significantly, and in that chapter, I also look at the way our culture actively alienates us from nature.
Before I definitely want to get into that. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about this concept of internal psychic landscapes.
Mm.
It seems like a really useful way of sort of looking at this problem of how we experience or think about nature. But I wasn't really familiar with the notion of an internal psychic landscape. Can you sort of talk about it a little bit, explain what that means?
Well, I think it starts with a sense that we have an inner world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we take in the outside world, which is a series of landscapes that we see, and it's peopled. And people and animals and everything and you know, flora and fauna and everything, it's in it. And we form an inner representation of our relationships with all these beings. Yeah? And mm-hmm. they interact with each other. And rather than see this in some disembodied way as like psychic space, just a space or an empty stage or something,
mm-hmm.
it occurred to me, you know, sitting working as a psychoanalyst and listening to patients' material, dreams, reflecting on my own experience and so on, actually, we dream in landscapes. You know, a patient will say, well, I was walking down the road and then there was a hill and a tree and, you know, then, you know, this animal came and whatever, you know, we actually, this is how we experience our inner world.
Mm-hmm.
We experience it visually to a very large degree, not only, but, you know, so that's where it started. And then the kind of landscapes that I was thinking about where once we have our inner world, we don't just think in terms of, you know, taking in something from outside that then looks exactly the same when it's on the inside. It's influenced when it's internal.
Mm-hmm.
It's dominated by how we arrange things in the landscape and our fantasies and so on. You know, so, and that's not exactly, you know, that doesn't correspond exactly with outside reality, although it's informed by outside reality. So, for instance, in terms of nature, you say something like environmental damage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we know that certain of our carbon-intensive ways of living are causing damage, but we can arrange the people that we relate to who are being damaged into groups that are far away from us.
Right.
In our imagination, we relocate them on the other side of the world. And then we don't feel so tormented by thinking about what they're suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or, and this is the really difficult thing with climate change, we sort of put them into a place that we call, you know, the future. And those people, groups of people, can be our own grandchildren. But we've psychically rearranged things so that they are spatially further away from us in our imagination. That's another thing that we do. So we create groups and we assign them, and we are on the principle that, you know, we've got some people closer to us and other people away from us, and that actually what governs all this is trying to preserve our own sense of being trouble-free, you know, not tormented by anxiety or guilt or shame or difficult emotions. So we rearrange our landscapes. That's the sort of thing that I've got in mind. Yeah.
Well, it really connects the concepts of how those operate as internally, like a defense, in a psychoanalytic sense. But it's also very literal in terms of politically how and culturally how climate change is represented. It's something that affects, say, people on tropical islands, but not us.
Yes.
Crop shortages will affect someone else and not us.
Yes.
So there's a real direct link, which was really striking to me in terms of how the psychoanalytic concept is really reflected in how a culture is denying this
Absolutely.
Reality.
And I want to bring in something else, another kind of rearranging that we do.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that I think that, and I think it's culturally driven, and that was my point in that article. I think that we arrange things so that we create, you know, what the psychoanalyst John Steiner called a psychic retreat,
mm-hmm.
which is like a little gated community, a little area in the mind where we can be free of all troubling, inconvenient feelings, all emotional discomfort. And in there, we can feel very superior, and you know, we're the in group.
Right.
But what we can also do is that we can do this with parts of ourselves, and this is the point I want to underline.
Mm-hmm.
So the part of us that actually doesn't feel superior feels very concerned. You know, isn't just a superior consumer thinking, well, I'll have it all for me, and I don't have to care about anyone else, and I don't even have to feel guilty about it. That I can push that all out there. You know. And send it to some faraway landscape, we also consign parts of ourselves that do care to being far away.
Right.
That's, you know, and it's only when we can get those parts back that we can reconnect with those parts. So I think the sort of spatial arranging we do is very, very extensive, and it actually applies to parts of ourselves as well.
Mm-hmm.
We outsource our caring sides and then look down on them, you know, tree huggers, and, you know, we denigrate the parts of ourselves that actually do care about what's going on in the world.
And getting back to, you describe it as a non-split natural landscape. I'm certainly wondering, and I'm sure our listeners are, how does one regain access to that part of the self that cares? I know it's a tough question. I don't know whether in your experience you're seeing or thinking about how that works.
Well, I'll give you an example, because it is a tough question, because I don't think it's something that you can just plan to do.
Right. It's like analytic treatment.
The other thing about these arrangings is that they're not conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're not very conscious anyway. But I'll give you a personal example of, because we're all in the culture and we all live in these split landscapes. So I was trying to, we have a very good public transport system in London,
mm-hmm.
and trying to get my carbon emissions down, I've taken to going on the bus. And one day it was really horrible weather, it was sort of spitting rain and very cold, and I was standing there and I deliberately not taken the car. And I heard myself and I thought, I just can't stand waiting for the bus. I can't stand it. And all of a sudden, something happened. This is what I mean. It wasn't planned. It was quite spontaneous. I have grandchildren, and my grandchildren, grown up and in the future, were very close to me there, as it were, at the bus stop. They were in their reality, and I was in my reality, and I heard what I just said. I can't stand waiting for the bus. And their reality was a devastated reality, and I was standing in a bit of bad weather. And suddenly I heard a certain kind of quality in my voice. I thought I sounded like a bit like a spoiled brat, you know? And I didn't like myself. Now, this is in my imagination, they weren't accusing me of anything, actually. But it sounded like, you know, that was the only justification I could come up with. I didn't like waiting for the bus. And so I was very shocked by this, actually. I thought what had happened at that moment is that some splitting had become undone. Because although I actually write about climate change and talk about it and think about it a great deal, and have even talked and thought about the effect on my grandchildren, I've never had an emotional experience like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it did something quite profound to me. You know, it undid some sort of mental separating where I put them in some other landscape. But here we were having a direct conversation. So I don't know if that's an answer to you.
No, it's very poignant, and
yeah.
I think it's a great illustration of what a non-split, if we could put it that way, experience would be, that there are these elements of love, elements of sadness,
mm-hmm.
A kind of reality, but then there's also a gesture of care. And maybe even kindness, all sort of richly blended into one experience or one image.
Mm. Now, the thing is that one can't plan these things. It happened. But it probably happened because of a lot of thinking about it.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that may also touch a bit on concepts that made a lot of appearances in the various essays in the book, the idea of ecological debt and ecological gratitude.
Yes, I mean, at this point, I just want to say something about the book because it's really not my book. I mean, right. I've got two chapters in it, but there are actually 23 authors in the book.
Right.
And you're referring to a chapter by someone called Ro Randall on ecological debt and gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thanks for pointing that out. Yes, it's a book edited by you. And like I said in the beginning, it's based on a 2010 conference, which is available on YouTube as well. Okay.
But getting back to what you were talking, you were asking me about, ecological debt.
And gratitude. And those seem to be feelings or feeling states, that may be an important counter to the sort of entitlement and omnipotence and, you know, splitting, you know, it's there's a grandiosity to this capitalist Western idea of, you know, self and versus nature. And a counter to that seems to be these ideas of ecological debt and gratitude. Would you see it operating that way?
Yes, I'll go on to that. I just want to make one point. I think, I want to say this. I don't think that the issue, is simply about capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's about a state of mind. And it's about an uncaring state of mind that we get into. And it is a mindset that I think is very prevalent and driven by the culture under capitalism for various reasons. But I also think, it can apply to other cultures as well. You know, I just wanted to say that, because I think it's important. But to get to, ecological debt, Ro Randall's paper, she uses Dickens's Great Expectations as a vehicle for talking about ecological debt, where, you know, Pip thought that all his good fortune, for those of us who, you know, if you remember the story, were because of, I can't remember her name, oh dear, anyway, the benefactor that Pip thought he had wasn't the real one, which was the Australian convict who he'd helped when he was a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And she uses this imagery to Havisham,
right?
Yes. She uses this imagery to point out how, you know, we can think that our good fortune is our entitlement or because of this or that other qualities that we have. And we actually forget the enormity of our debt to the natural world. I mean, that we couldn't function without the natural world. And, you know, one of the ways that I sense this issue is, you know, you go into a supermarket and it says, you know, do this and that and the other thing to save, we're trying to save the planet, you know, as if it's in our gift.
Right.
To save nature, you know, it's a complete denial of just what we owe nature. And so, and those kinds of feelings mitigate and you come up against our omnipotence in the same way that they do in individual relationships, you know, in our personal relationships when we get more in touch with our gratitude, it tends to go with a bit more of a humble position, and counteracts something a bit more narcissistic in us, you know. But it's a very, very good chapter, to read on just the whole way of thinking about, ecological debt, which, as Randall points out, never appears on the balance sheets, what we owe. You know, in our economies.
Right. Yeah. The cost of cleaning up pollution isn't included in the cost of gas.
No.
That kind of thing.
No.
Right.
It's a polluter's charter. That's how everything's being framed in this culture.
Well, I don't want to stop this interview without talking about Shark Week. I don't know if you know what that is.
No.
You talk about nature programs in something that I found very interesting, and how the form of nature programs, the way that they're edited and put together, and the sound production is illustrative of this grandiose position vis-a-vis nature, I think. And I definitely want to get into that. But it had me thinking about nature programs. And I certainly grew up with David Attenborough programs, which, you know, had a sort of calm, reverent quality, I think.
Yes.
And, you know, spiritual even. And, you know, I was thinking about what we have now in America, at least, and sadly, you know, what comes to mind is Shark Week, which is a week of shows on a cable channel that are really hyped, you know, dramatic shows about sharks and shark attacks and how ferocious they are and that kind of thing. Other than that, I can't think of other popular representations of nature, at least here.
This is a very sad state of affairs.
It is sad.
Goodness me, yeah.
But you know, you talk about pumped up loud music. There's a reference to a review of a BBC One show called Lost Land of the Tiger, which is more about the cast members than about nature.
Yeah.
And this, the idea that there are loud flashbang noises and quick editing, and that there's even a whoosh sound with the editing and with the cuts. And that, you know, it's easy to find amusing in a way, but I found there's a lot of truth to it. Can you tell me sort of how you came upon this and how you put this together?
I think I'm a nature lover, and I follow nature programs, and I started to notice this change, and not only in nature programs, it's right across the board in cinema, because I'm also a cinema lover, a film lover.
Me too.
And you find the same phenomenon going on there. It started to seem to me like attempts to break up one's thinking and to break up a sense of, you know, that one had some sort of internal space to call one's own in which to think, you know, so that you get much more often TV programs, you know, sudden intrusive visual material of a violent nature, or that kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I started to think about, well, what's going on here? And it seemed to me this was anti-mind. It was anti-thinking. And I know I'm putting a lot of different things together here.
I think they all fit.
They do fit. Mm-hmm. I think they do generally fit in, you know, the message is stop thinking. Stop thinking in a way that is reflective and comes from some sort of caring position, to go back to Hannah Siegel, where there's a little fire burning of concern.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think it led me to see the culture as sort of predatory on our minds, actually, the current culture, and definitely anti-mind. And so, you know, I find all these trends quite disturbing, really.
Yeah,
and I think that if we pretend they don't have an effect on us, you know, they do, actually. We're not immune to these effects.
You know, I just found myself, I'll freely associate here, thinking about a film, I think from the late 30s, called Captain's Courageous, with Spencer Tracy playing a cod fisherman. a Portuguese cod fisherman off the coast of Newfoundland. I think I just associated to it because it's a story about a child overcoming grandiosity in the face of adversity with a feeling. I don't know. Have you seen the movie?
I haven't, no.
Captain's Courageous.
I'm going to look up this and Shark Week.
Well, look up Captain's Courageous and Shark Week, you know. I'll email you something about it. Anyway, we have a few minutes left. I wanted to ask you, it's been, you know, several years now since that conference and a couple since the book came out. What has it been like? You're doing some public speaking about climate change. What has your experience been of the kind of public reception of these concepts since you've been doing this?
I've been very heartened by the general reader's response to engaging with climate change. Mm-hmm. You know, it's had a very good reception, and I think you know there's an awful lot of material about climate change which looks at our attitudes and our behaviors, but this actually looks at how we feel and what it means to us. And it's as if there is a hunger for understanding at that sort of level, and for people wanting to be related to. So yes, it's had a very good reception, and particularly with beyond the mental health sphere, which has personally pleased me a lot. And I am talking and writing still, and have new projects and so on. It's still in the climate change area because I think the situation is so serious. But
can I ask what? Can you give us a sense of what you're working on now? Are you superstitious, or can you tell us a little bit?
The current thing I'm really writing about the culture and our need to break with the culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're actually going to make any progress to get our emissions down, because getting our emissions down and confronting our disavowal and this form of denial of how serious the situation is, I think are the most important things we face
right
here and now. So yes, I'm still I'm writing about the culture.
Well, I have to say, reading the book and all of the essays by all the various authors has really given me a sense of hope that I haven't seen or felt before about climate change. And I think precisely because how specifically it gets to the feelings around thinking about, you know, the reality of this topic. So I would really encourage people to go out and get the book, and even just as a psychoanalytic text, it's really fascinating. So again, the book is Engaging with Climate Change, Psychoanalytic and Interdisciplinary Perspectives, 2013 from Routledge. Sally Weintraub, thanks so much for joining us on New Books in Psychoanalysis.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
All right. Until next time, this is New Books in Psychoanalysis.